headlines, Iran's president starting an official visit to Russia says Tehran-Moscow cooperation can serve as a deterrent to global unilateralism. Israeli forces demolish a Palestinian home in the Flashpoint Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in the occupied East Al-Quds. Well, the World Health Organization is warning that the COVID pandemic is far from over, as many countries are facing a surge in Omicron infections.
Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News.
We start in Moscow, where Russian President Vladimir Putin is hosting President Ebrahim Raisi of Iran, arriving there a short while ago for a two-day visit. The two presidents are set to meet for wide-ranging discussions on matters that concern them. Raisi is also scheduled to give an address to a plenary session of Duma, the lower house of the Russian parliament. Prior to his departure, the Iranian president said closer cooperation would benefit both countries. He said stronger bonds between the two states would also help security, economy, and trade ties in the region and serve as a deterrent to global unilateralism. This is Raisi's third foreign visit since taking office in July. Iran's oil, foreign, and economy ministers are part of his entourage.
A meaningful leap forward. That's how the Iranian foreign minister termed the expansion of interactions between Tehran and Moscow ahead of Iran's president visit. In an article written for the Sputnik news agency, Hossein Amir Abdollahian talks about Tehran's new roadmap, based on which cooperation with all neighbors, especially those in the Russian Federation, is a priority. Describing Russia as a powerful neighbor and friend, with ties based on respect and mutual interests, the top diplomat says Tehran is setting the stage for expanded cooperation in a wide range of fields. From economy, culture and science to technology, defense and security, the opportunities for partnership are immense. Parliamentary and media projects also provide good grounds for cooperation. The two sides also have a lot to discuss when it comes to regional developments, including the West Asia region, South Caucasus and Central Asia, and international matters such as Vienna negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran deal. But how can these matters be addressed given the West's anti-Iran and anti-Russia approach? Tehran and Moscow share common views on geopolitical issues in West Asia, which is already facing numerous challenges, from war and foreign military interventions to economic instability. The situation in Afghanistan, Syria, and Yemen are some instances where the two sides share similar perspectives. Amir Abdollahian argues that by holding bilateral consultations and preventing third parties from playing a role in the region, the two states can settle regional issues, especially at a time when unilateralism has proven to be a failed strategy. On security, Moscow has provided Tehran with military equipment such as the S-300 missiles, which along with Iran's domestic advancements can help boost the nation's defense capabilities in the face of foreign threats and promote regional defense and security capabilities. This will also help the two countries expand their fight against terrorism. In the field of economy, the two countries have huge unexploited potential. The trade volume currently ranges between $2 and $3 billion a year, which is way below expectations. A 20-year cooperation agreement the two sides signed in 2001 expired last year. An extension of that agreement, probably to be brought up in the ongoing talks, will make it possible for both sides to boost trade, which experts believe can be upgraded to the level of $20 billion a year. The relationship takes on added significance, especially at a time when both countries are hit by U.S. sanctions. That can unite the two states by joint motivation to try and circumvent those sanctions by taking steps such as the exclusion of the dollar from their mutual transactions. As it seems, Tehran and Moscow are on the path to capitalizing on their political solidarity and expanding their relations, as well as consolidating their ties with other countries in the East to build a united front in the face of the West's hostile agenda.
Joining us now from the Russian capital is our correspondent, Marina Kortunova. Marina, welcome to the program. Talk to us about the significance of this trip by an Iranian delegation headed by the President Ebrahim Raisi, and also, if you may, what's on the agenda of this meeting for the next 2 days?
First of all, general words. It is planned to discuss the whole range of issues of bilateral cooperation, including the implementation of joint projects in the trade and economic sphere, as well as current international and regional topics. In addition, it is meant to pay attention to the implementation of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action on the Iranian nuclear problem. Well, now back to Russia. The dynamics of Russian-Iranian relations is as follows. In the first 9 months of the Iranian year, March-December 2021, trade between our countries increased by 41%, according to the Iranian Customs Administration. And the trade turnover between Iran and Russia is worth $1.655 billion. Despite the cheerful optimism and the dynamics of 41%, these figures are not particularly significant for the Russian Federation. So there will be one aspect of negotiations to boost these trade figures and to develop more trade between our countries. Iran, through its diplomatic mission in Russia, has already voiced its desire to become a regional operator for the purchase of Russian grain. I know that a terminal for this is being built in North City, and Iran plans to make the most of its transit routes, ports, and logistics as an operator between Russia, India, and China. Iran also made a grain offer to India and plans to join the EREU Customs Union, Eurasian Economic Union. Earlier, Foreign Minister Lavrov, following negotiations with his Iranian counterpart Abdullahian in autumn, said that Moscow positively assesses Iran's interaction with SCO and EREU countries. That is, Moscow and the Shanghai Group in China are powerfully helping Iran survive and trade. Thus, the temporary agreement leading to the formation of a free trade zone with Iran, signed on May 17th in 2018 and entered into force in October 2019, led to the fact that the trade turnover between the EREU countries and Iran increased by almost 20% to $2.9 billion, and it is not bad for a start, but Iran has grandiose plans. Russia has its own interests as well. So tomorrow, let us pass today's negotiations with President Putin. Tomorrow, the attention of the world press will be riveted on the long-discussed but not yet confirmed deal on the sale of Russian weapons to Iran in the amount of $10 billion. Which of the plans between Iran and Russia is destined to come true, and whether any surprises are prepared, we will find out tomorrow as well. But about one surprise, and what a surprise, we can say for sure with certainty, for the first time in history, the president of Iran will speak from the rostrum of the State Duma of the Russian Federation. And he will address the plenary session of the Duma, the lower house of the Russian parliament. And I must admit personally, and everybody here in Russia, that everyone was very surprised by this news. Not a single president of a foreign power has made an appeal in our Russian State Duma. So we are waiting with a big interest. Iran and Russia, which are both under Western sanctions, have in recent years developed close relations in political, security, defense, economic, and energy fields. And they are currently implementing joint projects in oil, gas, nuclear, and railway sectors.
Thanks a lot, Marina Kotanova, joining us from the Russian capital, Moscow. Elsewhere, several months since the Taliban seized power in Afghanistan and still no official recognition from world countries. Now the group is making another call to address the issue. The Taliban's acting prime minister has especially urged the Islamic countries to start the recognition and take lead in the process. Muhammad Hassan Akhund says if that happens, the Taliban will then be able to develop quickly. The Taliban formed a government after taking control over Afghanistan back in August. Since then, however, no country has recognized their administration. Even Afghanistan's neighboring countries have been reluctant, calling for an inclusive government to be formed there. Meanwhile, the U.S. and other Western states have frozen billions of dollars of Afghan banking assets, and its development funding has been cut off following the Taliban takeover. This is worse than the humanitarian situation in a country already ravaged by two decades of war. And today marks Gaza Day, a day in commemoration of the resistance of the people of the Gaza Strip against Israeli hostilities. This day was designated after a major Israeli military campaign against Gaza in 2008. During 22 days of that war, thousands of Palestinians were killed and many others were injured. However, the regime failed to achieve any of its goals and was pushed back due to the resistance of the Palestinian people. Iranians also mark this day to voice their support for the steadfastness of the Palestinians. For more than a decade, the Gaza Strip has been under a constant Israeli blockade. This in addition to the regime's other offensive operations, including the bombardment of civilian infrastructure, has affected the lives of more than 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza. And now to the occupied Al-Quds, where the Israeli regime has just demolished another home displacing yet another Palestinian family as part of its expansion's policy. In the early hours of the morning today, Israeli army bulldozers moved in to destroy the building located in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The demolition, as can be expected, outraged the local Palestinians. Israeli security forces were also present at the scene, and they arrested a total of 18 people, including members of the family who lived in that building. The family has been facing an eviction threat since 2017. Israel says a school will have to be constructed on the parcel of land where the home was located. The fate of hundreds of Palestinians living in the controversial neighborhood has been hanging in the balance for years. The regime has been seeking to drive out dozens of families living there. Palestinians see the move as part of Israel's ethnic cleansing and Judaization attempts. We spoke with our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Candil, a short time ago. She says Palestinians are hoping that the international community would intervene to stop Israel's demolitions and land grab in the occupied territories.
The Palestinians have been demanding the international community that at the time the Israeli authorities are forcing people out of their homes in the lands that are occupied in 1967, then the appropriate solution would be to return them back to their lands and to their homes that were occupied by the Israelis in 1948. This is would be the first solution. However, the Israelis are refusing to give back Palestinians their rights, and at the same time, they are trying to let more Palestinians live in new Nakba at the time they give the Israeli settlers lands and homes and make their life easy in Al-Quds and other areas. The international community had been calling on the Israeli regime to stop the illegal demolition of the Palestinian homes and properties, especially that many properties had been funded by the European Union itself. But as usual, Israel acts as a state above the law. It ignores these calls, so Palestinians are still hoping from the international community and the EU to act, to translate their statements into actions on ground and not to only issue condemnations.
The growing leadership challenge is not the only political problem for British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government. His latest predicament is a record inflation level. Annual consumer price inflation is running at 5.4%. Inflation is widely expected to peak in April when household energy bills are regulated to increase by around 50%. The opposition is using this trend to further tighten the grip on Johnson. They're calling on the Prime Minister to offset the rise in energy bills. After a national weekend of action across Britain against a proposed new law that would give police extra powers to curb protests, the upper chamber of the country's parliament has introduced multiple amendments to it, while campaigners are calling for it to be thrown outside. Saeed Puruzaz's report from London.
The right to assemble, to be heard, a cornerstone of democracy, potentially under UK government legislation that give police sweeping new powers. It matters. Women being manhandled and handcuffed by police for attending a peaceful vigil held last year in the wake of 33-year-old Sarah Everard's murder at the hands of a police officer.
While the Conservative government claims the bill is aimed at proactively preventing chaos and disruption caused, for example, by people who glue their faces to motorways, its critics say the bill is not about law and order, but about taking away their right to protest.
The proposed legislation was quickly pushed through the House of Commons last year. This week, it was put up for debate at the upper chamber of the UK Parliament amid cries of kill the bill from drum-beating protesters, forming an emotive backdrop to it outside the legislative body. What ensued was several amendments made to the proposed legislation to the chagrin of the government. Campaigners say the parliamentary defeat came because people took to the streets and raised the alarm about the government's growing authoritarianism. They say it is now time to build the movement and kill the contentious bill once and for all. Saeed Purizup, London.
Well, the World Health Organization is warning that the COVID pandemic is far from over, as many countries are facing a surge in Omicron infections. The WHO chief has cautioned against the assumption that Omicron is milder than the previous variants. He says Omicron is causing hospitalizations and deaths like the other ones. It is now the dominant variant in the world. In recent weeks, European countries have broken new case records several times. France is reporting nearly 500,000 new cases a day. That's the highest ever recorded tally since the start of the pandemic. Italy has also registered a record single-day caseload of 228,000. A And EU officials claim those refusing to be vaccinated against COVID-19 and contributing to economic uncertainty across the 27-country bloc, more than 100 million adults in the EU, are refusing to take the jab. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The latest data published by the European Medicines Agency on Tuesday shows 20% of adults in the EU are unwilling to get a coronavirus vaccine, and only 40% of adults have opted to take a booster jab. Many citizens remain divided on the subject of vaccination.
For now, no. I don't know how safe is it. I don't know how safe is a vaccine to do it.
A lot of businesses getting shut down and stuff. So I think the faster we get the vaccine, the faster we'll open things back up.
Also on Tuesday, EU finance ministers met to discuss the impact of ongoing COVID-19 restrictions, supply chain bottlenecks, labour shortages, rising energy prices, and record high eurozone inflation.
While these negative factors are lasting longer than first anticipated, they should ease in the course of this year. We expect EU's economic growth to continue this year and next.
But that won't immediately fix the growing social crisis in the EU. Experts say the pandemic has highlighted the consequences of privatising essential services across the bloc, such as healthcare.
There is a problem behind, and in my understanding, it is very much ideological, because this idea of less state, less public investment, less public infrastructure, this is now paying off in a negative sense.
Due to continued partial lockdowns and travel restrictions, EU finance ministers say the true economic impact of Brexit has not yet been exposed. In this regard, it's claimed COVID-19 is actually acting as a shield for authorities in Brussels, but perhaps particularly in London. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani will live on forever and his enemies will disappear in history's dustbin, January 5th, 2022.
اونی که ما دیدیم از نزدیک کار او رو واقعاً مظهر تلاش بود. کار خستگی ناپذیر.
From what we observe of his work from up close, he was truly a manifestation of diligence and untiring work. After returning from trips to different countries, he would send me reports. When I would read those reports, I would be surprised at the massive amount of work that had been done over the course of a few days. I have kept a copy of some of those reports for myself and have written on them. I am keeping these so that they may be seen in the future, so that it will become clear how much work this man has done. I have copies of two or three such reports. Such was his untiring work.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
کار خستگی ناپذیر همراه با شجاعت یعنی کاری که کار معمولی نیست، احتیاج به شجاعت داره، احتیاج به شهامت داره.
And he worked courageously. His work was not regular work. It required courage and bravery accompanied by rationality. It required both courage and rationality, and these both existed in this man at an admirable level. He was a man of acumen. He knew both the enemy and their resources. It was not such that Marta Soleimani did not know what the enemy's resources were, resources which the enemy could exploit and with which it could strike. So he was completely aware of the enemy's resources, but at the same time, he would enter the field with complete courage and strength. He was not afraid of the enemy, and he would design strategies intelligently. I said this several times among the high-ranking officials of the country, both in the presence of Marta Soleimani himself and in his absence, that he did things wisely. On the one hand, he was courageous. Everyone is talking about his courageous acts and deeds. Furthermore, he would do things very intelligently. He was very meticulous. This is truthfulness. Of the believers are men who are true to the covenant which they have made with Allah.
اما اخلاص، اخلاص او، صدق و اخلاص. اگر اخلاص نباشه، کار بی برکت میشه.
As for his sincerity, if there is no sincerity, one's work will be devoid of blessings. When one's work is blessed, this is a result of sincerity. How can we tell he had sincerity? It was obvious, since he would shun being seen. He was not after being seen in any way. He would avoid being seen. But things have turned out in such a way that the entire world is seeing him. The whole world is seeing him.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is in hot water, facing a growing leadership challenge. Johnson had already run the gauntlet of public anger for his handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. Now, Johnson is under growing pressure from members of Parliament, some of whom Tory lawmakers, after revelations that he attended a garden party at his Downing Street residence in May 2020 in breach of his government's coronavirus lockdown rules. The scandal even worsened after it was disclosed that a party was also held in Downing Street the night before the funeral of Prince Philip last April, when mixing indoors was banned. The stories about rule-breaking get-togethers had caused deep anger, and to thousands who had lost relatives or friends to COVID-19, intense anguish and pain. The mix was potentially politically lethal for the entire Conservative Party, Johnson himself has shifted from the party's biggest asset, with a Brexit-fueled appeal separate to the Conservative brand, to its biggest liability. Not only had Johnson lost his respect, but also sticking with him risks further contaminating the party brand if the scandals continue. The UK government has launched an internal inquiry into revelations about multiple gatherings by Johnson's staff during COVID lockdowns. Johnson himself has apologized for attending what he called only a work meeting at a time when social mixing was banned. Meanwhile, the opposition, Labour, has seized the opportunity, saying Johnson broke the law, lied, and must resign. The opposition Labour Party, which has surged in the polls since the Partygate revelations began emerging last month, says Johnson is unfit for office. Sir Keir Starmer said the Prime Minister's actions and his inability to take any responsibility for them means he can no longer do his basic duties. A new poll released on Sunday showed that the Labour Party has opened up its biggest lead against the Tories since 2013 amid criticism leveled at Boris Johnson and his party over social gatherings during COVID-19 lockdowns. The poll conducted by Opinium says Johnson's personal approvals fall below the worst figures ever recorded by Theresa May. Just 22% of people approve of the job Johnson is doing as Prime Minister. Also, his party sinks to its worst vote shares since the general election, 10 points behind Labour. Also, around two-thirds of people surveyed believe Johnson and his colleagues have broken the rules and lied about it, and say Johnson should resign. That's why Boris Johnson secured a landslide election victory in 2019. But according to the poll, nearly half of Conservative voters at the 2019 election now say he should have stepped down. The Sunday Times reported that Johnson will look to get on the front foot and save his position by making a series of populist announcements in the coming weeks, including reducing the national health system backlog, tackling the small boat crossings in the Channel, freezing the BBC license fee for 2 years, and introducing a booze ban in Downing Street. But is that enough? The latest poll shows voters across the political spectrum are angry with the revelations, and most of those who supported the Conservatives in the 2019 election are turning against them. Add to it a looming cost of living crisis, inadequate public services, a pandemic to recover from, and ongoing difficulties caused by Brexit. It's now just a question of how long will Boris Johnson survive as the Prime Minister. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi hosted his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian in the city of Wuxi in Jiangsu province on Friday. The Chinese and Iranian foreign ministers announced the launch of a 25-year cooperation agreement aimed at strengthening economic and political ties. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the strategic cooperation agreement between Tehran and Beijing is built on a win-win approach in line with the interests of both countries. The Iranian diplomat outlined the latest state of bilateral cooperation in various fields and said Tehran is resolved to implement all infrastructure agreements with Beijing. Iran and China signed the landmark Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement in March last year in defiance of the U.S. unilateral sanctions to strengthen the long-standing economic and political alliance. It paves the way for Iran's participation in the Belt and Road Initiative, a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Meanwhile, Beijing once again voiced its firm opposition to unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran. The Chinese foreign minister said the U.S. bears primary responsibility for the ongoing difficulties with Iran, having unilaterally withdrawn from a 2015 nuclear deal. The United States reimposed the sanctions that the agreement had removed and slapped new bans under different labels. Wang said China firmly opposes unilateral sanctions against Iran, political manipulation through topics including human rights, and interference in the internal affairs of Iran and other regional countries. He also noted that Beijing completely supports Iran's wise stand toward the bullying policies of the United States and also its position on the ongoing talks with the five remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear agreement, urging Washington to make up for the past mistake in withdrawing from the deal.
That this 25-year agreement with China represents new possibilities for Iran to really, if not break out of the sanctions, at least they have a lifeline for the things that they will need thanks to this long-term agreement with China. And for China, of course, it's a major undertaking because it is long-term. They do expect it to last over two decades. So this is something that is a permanent feature of the political architecture. And I think it represents a tremendous opening for Iran to retake its own rightful place in the array of nations of the world, in the Middle East and globally.
Since Washington's 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, followed by subsequent sanctions aimed at crushing the Iranian economy, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has underlined the necessity of pressing ahead with efforts to neutralize the sanctions. Under that strategy, Iran has tried to adopt an east-oriented economic policy, expanding its ties with neighboring and other Asian countries and striving to become self-sufficient in key domains. China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from the country. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. Also, a review of trade between Iran and Russia shows Tehran's exports to Moscow increased by 58%, including 62% in agricultural and food products in the first 9 months of the current Persian year, which ends on March 20th. Tehran says a long-term cooperation roadmap between Iran and Russia is at its final stage of development as the Islamic Republic takes the initiative to expand its ties with neighboring, regional, and friendly countries to neutralize sanctions.
China and Russia are fighting back. They're going to be playing a major role. They're going to maintain their relations with the countries that they have a good relationship with and Iran is one of these. And they're not going to be bullied by the independent or unilateral sanctions or even any other sanctions that would be placed on a country like Iran.
Tehran has also pursued the removal of sanctions through diplomatic channels, including the negotiations in Austria's capital, Vienna.
The eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA goes on in Vienna to revive the deal.
Tehran says all anti-Iran sanctions should be removed in a verifiable manner. Tehran also says the U.S. should give guarantees that it won't leave the deal again.
Tensions between Russia and the West are spiraling out of control. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to invade its western neighbor, Ukraine, citing increased Russian military activities along the border. Russia rejects the allegation and says its military buildup is to ensure security in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Back in December, Russia proposed two draft treaties to Washington and NATO that demanded assurances that western troops won't be deployed near Russian borders. Last week, U.S. and Russian officials held talks over the tensions. Soviet representatives from NATO and Moscow to de-escalate the situation. The talks ended without any significant breakthrough. Russia now says it has run out of patience with the West as tensions escalate over Ukraine. Moscow expects the U.S. and NATO to provide by next week a detailed written response to its security demands.
We're waiting for the written reaction. We have reasons to believe that our partners have understood the necessity to react quickly, precisely, and on paper. And they have understood that we're not going to wait forever. But of course, there are plans to drag it on and on.
Sergei Lavrov says Moscow needs legally binding guarantees, and meeting these demands would be essential for finding a diplomatic solution. According to Lavrov,
His country has various options if the West rejects its security proposals.
I think the most likely thing is that they would announce that they're putting ships off the American coast with hypersonic weapons on them that could reach American cities within 5 or 7 minutes, similar to the threat they say they're facing in Eastern Europe. I think there are things they could do in Ukraine, for example, hitting the Azov battalion or some of the bases the Ukrainians have put on the Sea of Azov. They could deploy weapons to Kaliningrad Oblast. They could be announcing the targeting of European capitals. I think there are many things they could do to increase the pain level in Europe.
Russia has long warned against Ukraine's possible membership in NATO, describing it as its red line. Russia is raising the stakes by suggesting that it might deploy military hardware to Venezuela and Cuba if the escalation talks fail. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov, who led Russia's delegation in a meeting with the U.S. on Monday, says the move depends on the actions of the Americans. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan dismissed the warning as bluster, adding that the paths forward are either diplomacy or confrontation.
I think there's a chance of a compromise, but I think the chances are extremely small. I know some observers have taken some indications that maybe privately the Americans are willing to be more willing to make concessions to Moscow security demands, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think the Russians feel they were giving one last chance for the Western countries, particularly the United States, to see reason and give them security guarantees. I don't think that's going to happen.
Moscow and the West have had strained relations since the 2014 repatriation of Crimea from Ukraine to Russia, following a referendum in which more than 90% voted in favor of the move. The West, nonetheless, described it as illegal. The European Union and some other Western countries joined Washington in introducing several rounds of sanctions against Russia. The tense relations between the U.S. and Russia took a turn for the worse after Washington withdrew from Cold War-era IMF and Open Skies treaties. The recent tensions are definitely a cause for concern for people around the world, because if a second Cold War gets out of control, it could prove costlier than the first for all sides.
Arab intellectuals and ordinary people are still angry over UAE's normalization of ties with Israel. A number of intellectuals from Persian Gulf Arab states have announced that they will boycott a literature festival that is set to take place in Abu Dhabi in February. Omani writer Bushra Khalfan and Kuwaiti writers Mona Al-Shamri, Ahmed Al-Zamam and Ali Ashur decided to boycott the Emirates Airlines Festival of Literature.
Yeah, I guess this development indeed shows that there is a large number of people who disapprove. And that has been the case all along, because we need to keep in mind that these regimes are not elected by their population, and they don't necessarily make decisions on behalf of the population in these countries.
The intellectuals have cited UAE's normalization of ties with Israel for the decision to boycott the event. The list of invitees included writers, academics, and intellectuals from a number of Arab countries. Other writers from Persian Gulf countries have also been called to withdraw from the event. The festival will take place from February the 3rd to 13th at its new venue for 2022. UAE's image has been tarnished amongst Arab intellectuals and ordinary people for its decision to normalize ties. Palestinians have described the move as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
And of course, the public communication and freedom of speech is very strongly restricted in the UAE, which means that public dissent and in this case, and of course, public expressions against the normalization with the Israeli regime, of course, can lead to consequences for the populations.
The United Arab Emirates is amongst a group of Arab states that that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States in 2020. The Emiratis opened their embassy in Israel in July 2021. Israel has also opened an embassy in the Emirates capital, Abu Dhabi, and the consulate in the UAE business hub, Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals ranging from financial services to tourism. And in December, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett visited the UAE to further deepen the ties between the two regimes. The UAE was not the only country to normalize its ties with Israel. Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco have also established diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already vowed to help Israel normalize relations with additional countries in the Muslim and Arab worlds. Blinken said the Biden administration would continue to build on the successful efforts of the last administration to keep normalization marching forward.
Well, the Israeli colony is in many ways a proxy and a military base for the United States, and it helps secure the U.S. role in Western Asia and beyond. So, of course, the Israeli regime is of central importance for the United States, and expanding Israel's ties to the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and then potentially other governments and regimes in the region is, of course, of central interest because Israel is central for the military-industrial complex.
Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stance adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back.
Now, as a result, of course, the Palestinian struggle has not been of any importance, or has even rather become an obstacle for many of these regimes. But at the same time, of course, it does not reflect necessarily the popular mood in these places, where many people are, of course, pro-Palestinian and do support the liberation of Palestine.
Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. The
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim, alayhi salam, was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam al-Kadhim was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. We find that the biographers of Muslim history have unanimously agreed that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the greatest of the people when it came to obeying and worshipping Allah the Almighty. What is interesting is that these biographers have also written that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam suffered through many tortures and pains. He suffered through many hardships and trials and tribulations. For example, he was put into dark and isolated prisons. In these prisons, some which were incredibly small, no bigger than the size of two or three people put together. But in these dark prisons, it is written in the history books that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was tortured. And despite these tortures and trials and tribulations, those same biographers have written that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the greatest of the people in obeying and worshipping Allah. And these biographers have written that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was so great in his obedience and his worship and his ibadat and his ubudiyah of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, to the extent that he had calluses like that on the knees of a camel, upon his head or upon his knees, because of the great extent and the great number and the length of his prostrations, his sujood for Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. These, dear friends, are the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: لو ظهرت الآجال افتضحت الآمال.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, if times of death were revealed, expectations would be debunked.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in the beautiful conversations and dialogues of the esteemed and infallible Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam that he talks about this idea of earning our daily bread, of earning and working hard for our sustenance, for our livelihood. It's interesting, but throughout the ages, we have found that Islam has been corrupted in the sense where some ideas or some concepts have been forced into Islam and has confused the masses. One such thing which has been pushed into Islam is that idea that Muslims should be poor, Muslims should be paupers, Muslims therefore should be beggars. This, of course, is a dangerous and corrupt idea which has been pushed into Islam where the reality is that Islam promotes, encourages, urges an individual to go earn their livelihood, an individual to go and earn their daily bread, meaning make wealth, make money, be wealthy, have social status and financial status, but give it all, or let's not say all, let's say, but give it on the path of Allah. Yes, sometimes it is necessary to give everything on the path of Allah, as Lady Khadija, Ummul Mu'mineen, the wife of the Holy Prophet, did. She gave her wealth away, all of her wealth, in the path of Islam. And we find that the second divinely appointed Imam, Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, alayhi salam, multiple times he gave away all of his life's savings when it was needed. And so when it is needed, yes, sometimes we must give everything away. But still, earn money, make wealth, don't be poor, don't be a pauper, have financial status, but use this for the sake of Allah. Use this on the path of Allah. Don't become greedy when it is in reality Allah who has given you the sustenance, and the sustenance itself is from Allah. And so Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam was talking with one of his companions, and this companion by the name of Hassan bin Ali bin Hamza comes to him and says that he saw Imam Al-Kadhim working on the land to the extent where the feet of this blessed Imam were soaked with sweat. And so Hassan bin Ali bin Hamza asks Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam, may I be your ransom? Where are the men who will work with you? Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam responds, the one who is better than I and my father worked with their hands. So Hassan bin Ali bin Hamza says, who is this individual who was better than you, Imam Al-Kadhim, who was better than your father? Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam replies, it was Allah's messenger, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, and the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, and all of my forefathers worked with their hands. And so work is of the behaviors of the prophets, the apostles, and the righteous. And so, dear friends, we must work and earn our daily bread. We must work in order to provide for our families, and we must work in order to earn the sustenance which Allah has destined for us. And in the conclusion, we should spend this on the way of Allah for the sake of Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I want you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
So you have the Aql Daruni, you have the Aql which is internal Aql, then you have the Aql which is outside. And both of them needs to be in harmony for reaching or for that plight towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The emphasis on intellect, the emphasis on knowledge, the emphasis on mannerism, on adab, that's what Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, the Imams, promoted and showed in their akhlaq, in their behavior, and approach things. That's why, you know, Imam is known as Kazim, who controlled that, who had hilm, which is one of the qualities of God, who had hilm. And at the same time, the empathy that the Imam had, where he took the suffering of his own self, you know, so that others may not suffer.
Ya
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
What is it you would be trying to do on climate change? What is it you would be trying to prevent if you were leading the United States at the conference?
Well, first of all, I think one of the dumbest statements I've ever heard in politics, in the history of politics as I know it, was Obama's statement that our number one problem is global warming, okay? When we have large groups of people that want to blow up every one of our cities, that want to destroy our country, that want to kill our people, and he's worried about global warming. I think it's one of the dumbest things I've ever seen.
Having two cars, three cars in your family and a television set in every room and living that sort of life that people live in developed countries and even in emerging economies now has a cost to it. The cost is climate change.
And the time is running out. Time is running out. We've got 10, as the scientists say, we have 10 years to reduce our emissions by 90%. You know, we've got to keep 80% of the fossil fuels in the ground. That's a massive shift in our ways of life.
It is going to affect the way we do everything. It is going to affect the way we transport ourselves. It's going to affect what we eat, when we eat. It's going to affect how we heat, cool our homes. It's going to affect how we build our homes. It's going to affect mostly, certainly how we produce our food. It's going to affect practically every human endeavor.
If we fail in Paris, then the whole world is looking at a globally catastrophic situation, which will not spare anybody. It will hit the rich countries. New York will be affected. Berlin will be affected. London will be affected. It will affect everybody.
The average temperature on Earth has already risen by 1 degree Celsius. If we exceed 2 degrees Celsius of warming, most ecosystems will collapse. To prevent this, the United Nations has been trying to reach a global climate agreement since 1995. My film team and I are going to Paris to meet the people who are deciding about our future.
Guardians of the Earth. Part 2.
At an airport shielded by the military, over 150 heads of state make their arrival. It's the largest diplomatic gathering in history. And it's called COP21. We nearly lost our permission to film due to tightening security after the terrorist attacks Paris had suffered some weeks before. But ultimately, the UN does allow us to be among the world's leaders with our crew. The negotiations open in the big red plenary hall.
Distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, Paris must be where the world unites as one. Paris must be where we show that we are capable of standing in solidarity with one another. Dear friends, never before has a responsibility so great been in the hands of so few.
20,000 negotiators from all nations get to work on formulating the agreement's text. They're closely watched by 10,000 NGO observers and journalists. From the COP press president, we want to know what the obstacles to a final agreement are.
I have no doubt that we're going to reach an agreement here next year. The next week! Woo! Next week! Okay.